But the book of Esther. Let's just read a couple of verses here at the beginning of chapter 1. Now it came to pass in the days of Ahasuerus, this is Ahasuerus which reigned from India even unto Ethiopia over 127 provinces, that in those days when the king Ahasuerus sat on the throne of his kingdom, which is in Shushan the palace, in the third year of his reign, he made a feast unto all his princes and his servants, the power of Persia and Media, the nobles and princes of the provinces being before him. When he showed the riches of his glorious kingdom and the honor of his excellent majesty many days, even in 84 days. And we can have a word of prayer there. Now, Lord, we thank you for a chance to stand again here tonight. And, Lord, we all know what's transpired in days here and troubled minds and distractions and just a lot of nonsense. In the meantime, we remind folks that there are folks here with real troubles and some heartbreaks that are occurring even now. I pray that you'd be with those folks and give them some comfort. Lord, we look for thy hand tonight here and just showing us some things and maybe in some things that we normally don't look at and wouldn't look into thinking the Lord's hand wouldn't be there. But thy hand is in all places and you can use an awful lot that maybe even we wouldn't. And so I pray you'd give us encouragement by tonight, and may we know that the sovereign God of the universe, not the Calvinistic one, but the sovereign one, would love us and guide our lives and lead us in paths of righteousness. I pray you'd be with us. In Jesus' name, amen. All right, so we're going to kind of do a little survey, more than a sermon, I guess, tonight, of the book of Esther. Now, Esther's a tremendous human drama, as you know, and it's one of those Meyer to the choir stories that everybody loves. It's really a peon to a princess story, really a peon to a queen story, along the lines of Snow White and, you know, the Princess Diaries and all of the rest of us guys' favorite girly shows. But the Jews still celebrate, you know, what happened here as Purim. And so it's not something unknown to them. It is ironic that, and you probably know the fact, I don't know how long it's been since you thought about it, that neither the word God nor the Lord shows up in the book of Esther. And yet there's no book where the hand of God is more evident than in the book of Esther. And so it's just kind of really odd that way. It's a glaring emphasis by de-emphasis. It's just kind of strange how the Lord wrote his book sometimes. But you got to find it ironic that the Jews were able to find God in these events in Esther without God being mentioned or the Lord being mentioned, but they can't find the Messiah in the life of Jesus Christ. It's really strange. But sometimes I think that God in Esther worked a lot like God works in people's lives today. And, you know, here's David Spurgeon in jail and winds up saved and an evangelist. You wouldn't have picked a less likely character on the face of this earth to be an evangelist than David Spurgeon, right? But sure enough, there he is. So the Lord was working in a jail and working in a tattooed guy's heart and other stuff that tattooed guy probably did that we don't even know about and he won't talk about. But God works in that stuff. Now, this is like I said, this is kind of more of a survey of things than a sermon tonight, but Acts 2 uses a phrase, and regarding the coming of Christ, it said that by the determinate counsel and foreknowledge of God that Christ was crucified. Now, we believe that God is sovereign to the extent of having a determinate counsel and foreknowledge. We're not Calvinists, and we don't believe he's sovereign the way the Calvinists do. But we know that there is a determinate counsel and foreknowledge, and we know that somehow things come out at the end of the story like God said they will without him actually manipulating and forcing men to do it the way he would have it done. I don't know how that works, but I'm confident that's a true statement. So you have probably a preconception of what the determinate counsel and foreknowledge of God would look like. It's got to be something pretty auspicious, something pretty noble, you know, something pretty awesome, something that, you know, definitely shows God's handiwork, and, you know, God would use that. And I got thinking about some of that, and what I find here in the book of Esther is there's some things that you and I wouldn't think that God would use at all. And so what that means is that there's some things that God uses that are pretty easy to miss. And a lot of times they're just mundane, monotonous things that, you know, just happen in life, and you wouldn't think that, you know, that would mean anything. But as we go through this, I'd like you to stop and think as we hit each one, how much each one of these things was required for this story to end up the way it ended up. I mean, when we are done here, you think about which ones of these things could be left out, and the story still come out right. And so just keep that in the back of your mind. This all begins under a cloud of captivity, God's judgment. You might think that if you're ever chastened or judged of the Lord, that there's nothing in any of that that God could use, and that's not true at all. This whole story rose under the cloud of captivity and God's, frankly, wrath and judgment against Israel. But without this book, there's no Israel for Messiah to come and die for. So that's, you know, there's something profound that happened here, and you don't even find God by name in the whole book. And there's some things that he uses that are weird. And so the name of this sermon is The Hand of God. And like I said, more of a survey than anything else. It's just some places to find the hand of God. Here's for instance, the hand of God. Look down with me in verse 5. You know, the king's there with his glorious kingdom and excellent majesty. Verse 4, verse 5. And when these days were expired, king made a feast unto all the people that were present in Shushan, a palace, both unto great and small, even 7 days in the court of the garden of the king's palace, where were white, green, and blue hangings, fastened with cords of fine linen, purple, in silver rings, and pillars of marble. The beds were of gold and silver upon a pavement of red and blue and white and black and marble. And they gave them drink in vessels of gold, and the vessels being diverse one from another, and royal wine of abundance according to the state of the king. And the drinking, so they're drinking, I don't know if it was alcoholic wine or not. Probably was. And the drinking was according to the law, none did compel. For so the king had appointed to all the officers of his house, and they should do that they should do according to every man's pleasure. Also Vashti the queen made a feast for the women in the royal house which belonged to the king Ahasuerus. On the 7th day, when the heart of the king was merry with wine, so most likely alcoholic, he commanded Mehuman, Biztha, Harbona, Bigtha, and Abagtha, and Sethar, and Carcass, the 7 chamberlains that served in the presence of Ahasuerus the king, to bring Vashti the queen before the king under the crown, with the crown royal, to show the people and the princes her beauty. For she was fair to look on, but the queen Vashti refused to come. All right, let me just begin this by saying, you find the Lord's hand in a soap opera. You stop and think about this. This is funny. First of all, verse 10, you have a tipsy king. Now, you wouldn't think that the Lord would use a half-drunk king to get anything done, but the Lord did in this case. If the king hadn't got tipsy, maybe he wouldn't have called Vashti. And if he hadn't called Vashti, then there would be no need for a new queen. You know what I'm saying? So here you have, first of all, a tipsy king, verse 10. And on the 7th day, when the heart of the king was merry with wine, he commanded those guys, I've already named them once, so that's enough, in the presence of Ahasuerus the king, verse 11, to bring Vashti the queen before the king with a crown royal to show the people and the princes her beauty. Now some have made, you know, this a call to come and belly dance. And I don't find that in there. I grant the king was probably tipsy, but that doesn't mean he called her to come in and belly dance. So I really don't think that's the case. And so what reason did she have to refuse? Well, not a real good one. So you have a tipsy king and a prissy queen. She's determined she's not going to do it. She refuses. Verse 12. But the queen Vashti refused to come at the king's commandment by his chamberlains. Therefore was the king very wroth, and his anger burned in him. So she turns him down and says, no, I ain't coming. A stubborn queen, a rebellious queen. Now again, this looks stupid. Where's God in that? How could the hand of God involve itself in such trivial, royal, palatial nonsense? A half-drunk king and a queen that's a prissy face. How's the Lord in that? But again, I mean, if those things hadn't happened, then there's no need for a new queen. And Mordecai and Esther don't come into the picture. And if Mordecai and Esther don't come into the picture, you know, where are we at the end of the book? Well, keep rolling here. Look down, if you will. So we're talking at the hand of God in a soap opera. You maybe don't think that that would be a place to find God working, but you don't know where God works. It says down in verse 13, then the king said to the wise men which knew the times. Now, we looked at that last week, I know, and that was a sober lesson. But for so was the king's manner toward all with that new law and judgment. Now, here's a tipsy king. He's got one sheet to the wind, if not two. And his wife won't obey him. So he turns to the wisest men in the kingdom and says, what do I do? Verse 14, and the next unto him was Karshina and Sethar and Admathah, Tarshish, Merez, Marsena, and Memucan, the seven princes of Persia and Media, which saw the king's face and which sat first in the kingdom. What shall we do unto the queen Vashti according to the law? Because she hath not performed the commandment of the king Ahasuerus by the chamberlains. And Memucan answered before the king and the princes, Vashti, the queen hath not done wrong to the king only, but also to all the princes, to all the people that are on all the provinces of the king Ahasuerus. So you have this chauvinist pig little huddle. The king, who's half-lit, and all his wisest princes and wise men, all gathered together asking what they should do. I mean, the brain trust of the kingdom is gathered together. What are we going to do? The queen won't come. We can't send and just drag her in here. And so you have this chauvinist pig. Little group of people say, well, where's the Lord in that? A bunch of old men that, you know, are, chicken. Probably their wives peck them to death every night anyway. And they're gonna lay the law down to these women in this kingdom. Now, where's the hand of the Lord in that? Well, apparently it was in it, right? Go on down, if you will, to verse 15. What shall we do unto the queen of Vashti according to the law? I mean, they're gonna make a law. Come down on these women hard. If they don't do what I tell them, they're criminals. It's stupid. It's a soap opera. I think, you know, I can't help but think that maybe the Lord is up in heaven snickering at this thing, going, I'm going to have to use this somehow. Because it's just stupid. Anyway, verse 16. And Memucan answered before the king and princes, Vashti the queen hath not done wrong to the king only, but also to all the princes that are in the and to all the people that are in all the provinces of King Ahasuerus. For this deed of the queen shall come abroad unto all women. Now again, this is the brain trust of the kingdom, fritzed out because the queen won't come and show them their beauty, her beauty. And so now they're going to come down hard on them, all women. Come abroad on all women, so that they shall despise their husbands in their eyes. When it shall be reported, the king Ahasuerus commanded Vashti the queen to be brought in before him, but she came not. Likewise, Shall the ladies of Persia and Media say this day unto all the king's princes, which have heard of the deed of the queen, thus shall there arise too much contempt and wrath. If it please the king, let there go a royal commandment from him, and let it be written among the laws of the Persians and the Medes, that it be not altered, that Vashti come no more before King Ahasuerus. And let the king give her royal estate to another that is better than she. And when the king's decree, which he shall make, shall be published throughout all his empire, for it is great, all the wives shall give to their husbands honor. It's the law. Both the great and small, and the saying pleased the king. Well, I guess. And the princes and the king did according to the word of Memucan. And he sent letters unto all the king's provinces, and to every province according to the writing thereof, and to every people after their language, and every man, that every man should bear rule in his own house. Hear ye, hear ye. Thus saith the king, on the punishment of death, every man should rule his own house, and all the wives are to honor their husbands. Thus saith the king. What a ridiculous thing. How could God be in something so stupid? And yet, God used it, right? Where would we be without this part? You would have no need for a new queen. And so when Haman rose up, who would withstand him? Now, it's not just the hand of God found in a soap opera, but notice in chapter 2, starting in verse 1, notice that the hand of the Lord was in a Miss America pageant in Persia. Where's your sense of humor tonight? If I say toilet paper, will you laugh? What? It's only that that gets a laugh today. Okay, 2:1. After these things, when the wrath of King Ahasuerus was appeased, he remembered Vashti and what she had done and what was decreed against her, and said, "Then said the king's servants that ministered unto him, let there be fair young virgins sought for the king, and let the king appoint officers in all the provinces of his kingdom, that they may gather together all the fair young virgins unto Shushan the palace, to the house of the women, under the custody of Haggai, the king's chamberlain, keeper of the women. And let their things for purification be given them. And let the maiden which pleaseth the king be queen instead of Vashti. And the thing pleased the king, and he did so." It's a Miss America pageant in Persia. And it's kind of a tawdry, you know, set of events. I mean, I can hear the women's rights advocates squealing now. But, and, you know, twice, fair young virgins, make sure they're pretty and young, but especially pretty. And so they go and get all these fair young virgins. Now, again, kind of tawdry, right? Here's, conceptually, maybe he was an old man, but conceptually he might have been an old man. And going out into all the kingdom and all the provinces, finding the youngest, prettiest young virgins to bring to the king, and he gets his pick of them all. It's kind of tawdry, right? Kind of like something you wouldn't think God would use, but turns out God did use it. Because whatever's the case, the king picked the one he thought was prettiest, and it was Esther. it's the hand of God in this thing, you see. I didn't say that you should choose to do something tawdry, but I bet the Lord's used something that you've done tawdry before in spite of it. Well, you bet. So not only that, but here we are, and it says down at the end of verse 4, let the maiden which pleaseth the king be queen instead of Vashti. Let the maiden which pleaseth the king. At the whims and passions of a king. Just a dirty old man, not even saved, probably. But, you know, I don't know if he liked, you know, light eyes or dark eyes or slender women or not slender women. I don't know what his preferences were, but you're going to leave a nation in the balance, letting a dirty old man pick who he likes the best? Doesn't seem like something God would use. But Lord did use it. As it turns out, Esther was the one that was chosen. So he used a soap opera. Then he used a beauty pageant. And then it gets a little more serious. And down in verse 5 of chapter 2, you're introduced to Mordecai and Esther. And in Shushan the palace, there was a certain Jew whose name was Mordecai. He was the son of Jair, the son of Shimei, the son of Kish, a Benjamite. It's ironic that the man that winds up number 2 to Ahasuerus the king was actually one of the offspring of Kish, who was in the tribe, that was Saul's tribe. So the king that messed everything up for Israel, way down the lineage, here's a guy of the same lineage that is responsible for saving Israel. Isn't that something? It's kind of ironic, isn't it? And God used it. But here's Mordecai, verse 1, or verse 5. Now, Shushan the palace, certain Jew of that family who had been carried away from Jerusalem with the captivity, which had been carried away with Jeconiah, king of Judah, whom Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon, had carried away. And so here is Mordecai. And Mordecai is living a life in captivity. He has no reason to expect, really, anything but death. And you wouldn't expect God to reach down and use a captive, but he did over and over in the Word of God. Here is Mordecai, but it says more in verse 7. He brought up Hadassah, that is Esther, his uncle's daughter. So if she's his uncle's daughter, then she's his cousin. So I'm presuming that he's probably an older cousin. And his uncle's daughter, for she had neither father nor mother, and the maid was fair and beautiful, whom Mordecai, when her father and her mother were dead, took for his own daughter. Now, 2:7 says she's fair and beautiful. That might be a bad thing in captivity. A young girl who is young and fair and beautiful, somebody might cast their eye on her and decide to take some of that, right, and ruin her life. How in the world is this story going to wind up good? A beautiful young captive. It's only going to be a matter of time. But the Lord did use it. And so you think about that, and captivity is pretty far down the pike, but it's never too late for God's hand to work in your life. You know what I'm saying? And you may be in a situation that's very threatening, like she was, but it doesn't stop the Lord from working in it. You should remember that, right? And lo and behold, chapter 2, verse 8. So it came to pass when the king's commandment and his decree was heard, and when many maidens were gathered together into Shushan, into the custody of Haggai, that Esther was brought also into the king's house, to the custody of Haggai, keeper of the women. And the maiden pleased him, and she obtained kindness of him, and he speedily gave her her things for purification, which with such things as belonged to her, and 7 maidens which were meet to be given her, and of the king's house, and he preferred her and her maids unto the best place of the house of the women. And Esther had not showed her people and her kindred, as Mordecai had charged her, that she should not show it. Now she found favor, and I think it's talking about Haggai there, the keeper of the women. She found favor with him. This thing, though, I mean, think about this. Verse 11, Mordecai walked every day before the court of the women's house to know how Esther did and what should become of her. Now, when every maid's turn was come to go into King Ahasuerus, we'll talk about that in a second, after that she had been 12 months, this thing played out for 12 months. Now, you don't usually think about that when you read through here, because it seems like it would happen quickly. But this whole, you know, parade of women thing took 12 months to play out. And so sometimes, you know, you expect a quick answer once again. And you think when you have prayed a month and the Lord hasn't done anything that you've been forsaken. And that's not true. The Lord's hand worked in this thing, and he brought this woman, Esther, into the favor of Haggai, the keeper of the women. And it goes on down here in just a little while and talks about some other things. But notice in verse 13, "Then thus came every maiden unto the king. Whatsoever she desired was given her to go with her out of the house of the women unto the king's house." Now, you might think something bad happened there, and it looks like an overnight stay. We'll talk more about it in a second. "But in the evening she went, and on the morrow she returned unto the second house of the women, to the custody of Sheashgaz, the king's chamberlain, which kept the concubines." So the king has concubines too. And it says in verse 14, "She came in unto the king no more, except the king delighted in her, and that she were called by name." Now, when the turn of Esther, the daughter of Abihail, the uncle of Mordecai, who had taken her for his daughter, was coming to go in unto the king, she required nothing but what Haggai, the king's chamberlain, the keeper of the women, appointed. And Esther obtained favor in the sight of all them that looked upon her. So Esther was taken unto King Ahasuerus, unto his house royal, in the 10th month, which is the month Tebath, in the 7th year of his reign. And lo and behold, the king loved Esther above all the women, and she obtained grace and favor in his sight more than all the virgins. Now, again in verse 19, all the virgins. I don't think that the king is abusing these young women who are going to be his queen. He's got concubines. And looks to me like he's doing the honorable thing by these women, and whoever will be queen will then be his wife, right? That's how I read it. But you go on down here, and as you know, verse 17, this thing turns out so that he set the royal crown upon her head and made her queen instead of Vashti. Now, how does that happen? Lord uses a beauty pageant. Lord uses this soap opera, this silly thing, a tipsy king and a bunch of old chauvinist pigs all gathered around making decisions about, you know, well, we got to put these women under some dumb thing like that. And the Lord's in it and blesses it. Before you know it, Esther is queen. It says in verse 18, "The king made a great feast unto all his princes, his servants, even Esther's feast. He made a release to the provinces, gave gifts according to the state of the king. And when the virgins were gathered together the second time, then Mordecai sat in the king's gate. Esther had not yet showed her kindred nor her people as Mordecai had charged her, for Esther did the commandment of Mordecai, like as when she was brought up with him." We'll talk more about that in a second, but as much as anything, Mordecai was running the show here between those two. Now it says in verse 21, then there's something else. So you leave, you know, now she's queen. The beauty pageant, Lord worked through the beauty pageant, and the one that he liked the very best of all the fair young virgins in the provinces happened to be Esther. So now she's queen. Well, in verse 21, "In those days, while Mordecai sat in the king's gate, two of the king's chamberlains, Bigthan and Teresh, of those which kept the door, were wroth and sought to lay hand on the king of Ahasuerus. Thing was known to Mordecai, who told it to Esther, the queen, and Esther certified the king thereof in Mordecai's name. And when inquisition was made in the matter, it was found out, therefore they were both hanged on a tree." So the Lord's hand is in the calling of the cops. That's what he did. He called the cops. I don't know how he found out exactly, but he got word of it, and he's been out there praying for Esther anyway, so he went ahead and decided to do the right thing. And report it. So he called the cops. And when he called the cops, and this conspiracy was worked out and understood and those guys were killed, at the end of verse 23, it was written in the book of the Chronicles before the king. That sure plays a role later. You already know the story. You see, folks, you sometimes find the Lord's hand in some things that you might not think that his hand would be in. Sometimes, you know, having the cops called on you probably helps some of you. Right? And sometimes you simply have to call the cops. All right. In chapter 3, verse 1, after these things did King Ahasuerus promote Haman, the son of Hammedatha the Agagite, and advanced him, set his seat above all the princes that were with him. Now, you kind of begin to see here how this might have worked. See, now the Lord has Mordecai and Esther in place for the devil's counterpunch. I think the Lord must have known this was coming all along. And so he was willing to use a soap opera and to use a beauty pageant and to use a tipsy king and a, you know, prissy queen so that he had the right chess pieces in place to save a nation. And you, when, you know, at the early part of the chapter, you wouldn't think that that's where this is headed, that he's going to save the nation this way. But it works out this way. Now notice, along that line, notice some things. This gets a little closer to where we used to are accustomed to living. And all the king's servants that were in the king's gate bowed and reverenced Haman, for the king had so commanded concerning him. But Mordecai bowed nor did him reverence. Now, that's an uncompromising man. In verse 3, then the king's servants, which were in the king's gates, said unto Mordecai, why transgressest thou the king's commandment? Of course, this made Haman really, really mad. And what happens here is then, of course, Haman gets his undies in a bunch and sees that Mordecai is the one that's not doing him proper obeisance. And so, you know, he's, you know, figures out a way to get this thing squared away. He's going to wind up killing the Jews. And so there's something to be said about Mordecai in that it looks like Mordecai is actually to blame for sicking Haman on the Jews. I mean, after all, is captivity really a place to demonstrate against the appointment of a guy that the king has every right to appoint? I mean, is this really time to open your big mouth? You're in captivity. And some would say, why don't you just bow the knee and keep your yap shut? Because what this has done now is brought all this down on our heads. It looks like Mordecai is going to be the cause of the Jews' downfall. But that neglects the Lord's feelings about something. Go back, if you will, in the book of Exodus real fast. Exodus 17. Keep a finger in Esther. Exodus 17. Exodus 17. And go down to verse 14. Exodus 17, 14. And you know at this point that Joshua fights against Amalek, who is the progenitor of Agag. And verse 14, the Lord said unto Moses, write this for a memorial in a book and rehearse it in the ears of Joshua. For I will utterly put out the remembrance of Amalek from under heaven. And Moses built an altar and called the name of it Jehovah Nissi. For he said, because the Lord hath sworn that the Lord will have war with Amalek from generation to generation. The Lord is out to whoop Amalek. And that's who Agag came from. Look at another passage here real fast. Deuteronomy 25. Deuteronomy 25. Deuteronomy 25, 17. Remember that Amalek did unto thee by the way when ye were come forth out of Egypt, how he met thee by the way and smote the hindmost of thee. That's what Amalek does, is attacks from behind. Even all that were feeble and behind thee, feeble behind thee, when thou wast faint and weary, and he feared not God. Therefore it shall be, when the Lord thy God hath given thee rest from all thine enemies round about, in the land which the Lord thy God giveth thee, for an inheritance to possess it, that thou shalt blot out the remembrance of Amalek from under heaven. Thou shalt not forget it. Now, in 1 Samuel 15, I think it was, the Lord commanded Saul to go destroy Amalek and Agag, and the king. And as you know, Saul spared him. And Samuel wound up having to go in there, and that was what got Saul kicked out of the kingship. And Samuel went in there and slew Agag. In fact, he hacked him in pieces. Now, that's how much God hated Amalek. And the point is, to say that all that, is that God said, I'm going to have war against Amalek from generation to generation. Now, in this chapter, Agag, this guy Haman, is an Agagite. He's an Amalekite who's from Agag. And so, you know, here is Mordecai who refuses to bow. And it's like, come on, man, we're in captivity here. Honor the powers that be. But Mordecai had been reading his Bible. And whatever you can say about it, I'm not for causing trouble if trouble doesn't need to be caused. But Mordecai was not going to bow the knee to that guy. This is just as noble a thing as the Hebrew children not bowing the knee to the image on the plain of Dura. And what that means is that Mordecai had been reading his Bible. That means that part of the reason God did what he did was with replacing Vashti, with whom he replaced her, was to put Mordecai in a place to stand against Haman, the Agagite, so that in the end, by the time this is over, Haman the Agagite is hanging from his own gallows. You say, the Lord works like that? Where do you get the idea that God is against stirring up trouble? If trouble needs to be stirred. Don't worry, I'm not talking about throwing a brick through the federal building or anything like that. But where do you get the idea that God is just for always pacifying things and, you know, being real soft and stuff? You don't get it from the book. And so what I'm saying here is that the Lord's hand was in an uncompromising man. And that's more along the lines that we understand better than beauty pageants, which you might not think that God would use, but he did. Or soap operas, which you might not think the Lord would use, but he did. I'd like you to notice this. So in chapter 3, verse 9, if it please the king, let it be written that they be destroyed. This is Haman talking about the Jews. And said, let them be destroyed. And so there's a writing made, and he undertakes to start this destruction of the Jews. Why does the Lord allow that to go through? Because in the end, he wants to trap Haman and kill him. But you wouldn't have thought that, just sitting there in the gate trying to figure out what's going on. That's not how you'd think, right? But God's hand was in that. I'd like you to see, I would like to speed up here and go a little faster here, but look in chapter 4, verse 1 real fast. When Mordecai perceived all that was done, so now there's this writing been made, and now on a certain day the mighty men of Persia are going to go out and kill the Jews. When Mordecai perceived all that was done, Mordecai rent his clothes and put on sackcloth and ashes and went in unto the midst of the city and cried with a loud and bitter cry. Came even before the king's gate, that none might enter into the king's gate clothed with sackcloth. And in every province, whithersoever the king's commandment was, his decree came. There was great mourning among the Jews, and fasting, and weeping, and wailing, and many lay in sackcloth and ashes. So Esther's maids and her chamberlains came and told her. Then was the queen exceedingly grieved, and she sent raiment to clothe Mordecai, and to take away his sackcloth from him, but he received it not. Now what you're seeing happen here is you're seeing the actions of a righteous man and that man's prayers. And then you see that there's this relationship built out of compassion that he had on this cousin of his whom, you know, he could have put off on somebody else. But Mordecai and Esther have a relationship together. And He was a friend to her and essentially a father to her and all those sort of things. And so there's something special between them. Look, sometimes we get a little careless with the relationships that we have. First of all, with our kids. Some folks are, you know, they love them and all those things, but some fathers are not very careful to talk to their kids. And that's a shame. Because you can't have a great relationship with your kids without talking to them. And you can't have a great relationship with your wife without talking to her either. And you can't have a great relationship with your husband without talking to him either. Right. My dad and I never talked. I learned about the birds and the bees the hard way. By watching the cows. When I asked, he said, "You see those cows over there?" I said, "Yeah." He said, that was his explanation. We never talked. You can do better. But you see here that there's, you know, God is in this relationship between Esther and Mordecai. And of course, there's fasting and prayer. And then you get down to chapter 4, verse 16. And Esther then sees the writing on the wall that she wasn't put in this place for nothing. So in verse, let's start with verse 13. Then Mordecai commanded to answer Esther, Think not with thyself that thou shalt escape in the king's house more than all the Jews. For if thou altogether holdest thy peace at this time, then shall their enlargement and deliverance arise of the Jews from some other place. God's put you and me in place, and if we don't act, then the Lord will raise deliverance from some other place. But, I mean, so the question becomes, do you want it to be you, or do you want somebody else to do it? The Lord's given you a unique position wherever you are, probably, to reach some people. So do you want to be a steward of what the place the Lord's put you and let the Lord use you, or are you going to renege and let somebody else do it? So sometimes the Lord takes volunteers. Sometimes the Lord doesn't use a volunteer like the volunteer wants to be used. But the Lord sometimes uses a volunteer. And like I said, you know, the Lord did all this stuff. It was all His hand. But it still came down to somebody being willing to go forward. And this woman exhibited something that's needed. It says, "But thou," verse 14, "and thy father's house shall be destroyed, and who knoweth whither thou art come to the kingdom for such a time as this." Then Esther bade them return Mordecai this answer, "Go gather together all the Jews that are in that are present in Shushan, and fast ye for me, and neither eat nor drink 3 days, day or night. I also and my maidens will fast likewise, and so will I go into the king, which is not according to the law, and if I perish, I perish." You see, if she shows up in the courtyard and he doesn't extend the golden scepter, she's dead meat. If he's having a bad day, and he don't want to see the queen today, and he goes, "Nah." He doesn't extend the scepter, she's dead meat. And so she's taken her life into her own hands by walking into that particular vestibule, letting herself be seen as wanting an audience with the king. If he doesn't extend the scepter, she's dead. So there's courage. And the Lord works through courage sometimes. Sometimes you have to have guts to do what the Lord wants you to do. And the Lord's hand uses courage. Now, if it's stupid, then that's something else. And so the queen goes in, and he extends the golden scepter in chapter 5, verse 2. And she has an unusual request. Then said the king to her, verse 3, "What wilt thou, Queen Esther, and what is thy request? It shall be given thee to the half of the kingdom." And Esther answered, "If it seem good unto the king, let the king and Haman come this day unto the banquet that I prepared for him." So you went through all that rest of your life to go to a banquet. By the way, notice the banquet, chapter 7, verse 7. "The king arising from the banquet of wine." It wasn't a buffet, bar. It was a banquet of wine. You say, was it alcoholic? I don't know. Probably not. You say, well, would the Lord use that? apparently. He says, I want you to come to a banquet of wine. Go down to verse 8 of chapter 5:8. I found favor in the sight of the king, and if it please the king to grant my petition and to perform my request, let the king and Haman come to the banquet that I shall prepare for them. And I will do tomorrow as the king hath said. And so, you know, at that point, Haman goes forth and he is flying sky high, because he's been invited to a banquet with the king and the queen, and this has got to be good. It's got to be a promotion for me. So he goes home and he's bragging. The only problem is along the way he sees Mordecai once again in the gate, and once again Mordecai does not do obeisance to him, right? And so in verse 9, Haman saw Mordecai in the king's gate, and he stood not up nor moved for him, and he was full of indignation against Mordecai. And, you know, Mordecai has ruined my entire day. Here's the greatest day of my life. I have been not only promoted, but I have been invited to a private banquet between the king and the queen and me, and this dork of a Jew has ruined everything for me. He goes home and complains to his wife. And so his wife gives some advice. Verse 14, then said Zeresh, his wife, and all his friends unto him, let a gallows be made of 50 cubits high, and tomorrow speak ye unto the king that Mordecai may be hanged thereon. Then go thou in merrily with the king unto the banquet. And the thing pleased Haman, and he caused the gallows to be made. See the Lord's hand now? You see, I mean, we all know how the story ends. We know that Haman's going to wind up hanging from those gallows. But you see what the Lord's done with this thing? He's used things that maybe some folks wouldn't think he would use to manipulate circumstances where this guy's about to get it in the back. And so it goes on down in chapter 6, verse 1. There's something else the Lord uses, and maybe you wouldn't usually think of this, but a king's insomnia. You wouldn't think that a bad night's sleep would do this to a guy, but chapter 6, verse 1, on that night could not the king sleep. And so, of all things, he commanded to bring the book of the records of the Chronicles. They were read before him. I mean, he didn't even bring in Calvin and Hobbes or something of pleasant reading to of all of the, you know, the record, the Chronicles of the records, please. Interestingly, what's discovered in the Chronicles of the Records is Mordecai having reported to the cops that there was this conspiracy against the king. The king hadn't seen that before, didn't know the name of the guy that had reported this. And so for the first time, Mordecai's name comes up to the king. And now you know why that was written down. And the Lord was in that. So sometimes you got to call the cops. Right? So the king's insomnia. And then, of course, as you know, this goes on down the pike here. What honor, verse 3, and dignity has been done to Mordecai for this? I mean, I want to reward him. He saved my life. And the king said, who's in the court? Now, Haman was coming to the outward court of the king's house to speak unto the king to hang Mordecai on the gallows that he had prepared for him at the behest of his wife. His wife advised him to do that. And the king's servant said unto him, behold, Haman standeth in the court. The king said, let him come in. Now Haman thinks he's going to win, right? It's remarkable. Verse 6, so Haman came in, and the king said unto him, what shall be done unto this the man whom the king delighteth to honor? Typical of an egotist. Now Haman thought in his heart, to whom would the king delight to honor more than me? And Haman answered the king, for the man whom the king delighteth to honor, let the royal apparel be brought, which the king useth to wear, and the horse that the king rideth upon, and the crown royal which is set upon his head, and let his apparel and horse be delivered to the hand of one of the king's most noble princes, that they may array the man withal whom the king delighteth to honor. It's going to be me. I'm going to look nice in that crown. And bring him on horseback through the street of the city and proclaim before him, thus shall it be done to the man whom the king delighteth to honor. And the king said to Haman, make haste and take the apparel and the horse as thou hast said, and do even so to Mordecai the Jew that sitteth in the king's gate. Let nothing fail of all that thou hast said. Then took Haman the apparel and the horse and arrayed Mordecai, brought him on horseback through the street of the city, and had to proclaim before him, thus shall be done unto the man whom the king delighteth to honor. the Lord's hand is in an Antichrist's humiliation and in a hero's exaltation. Keep on reading just a little more. Verse 12, and Mordecai came again to the king's gate, but Haman hasted to his house mourning and having his head covered. And Haman told Zeresh, his wife, and all his friends everything that had befallen him. It was a Facebook account. Then said his wise men and Zeresh, his wife, unto him, if Mordecai be of the seed of the Jews before whom thou hast begun to fall, thou shalt not prevail against him, but shall surely fall before him. And while they were yet talking with him, came the king's chamberlains and hasted to bring Haman to the banquet. And that timing is just precious, isn't it? And so, I mean, I know how y'all know how this all ends, but here in chapter 7, they go in and, you know, what's this all about? And Queen Esther makes an appeal to the king, and he says, well, who's going to do this? And she said, that guy right there. And I mean, the king hit the roof, right? Notice chapter 7 and verse 6. And Esther said, the adversary and enemy is this wicked Haman. And Haman was afraid before the king and queen. The king, arising before from the banquet of wine in his wrath, went into the palace garden. And Haman stood up to make request for his life of Esther the queen, for he saw that there was evil determined against him by the king. Then the king returned out of the palace garden unto the place of the banquet of wine, and Haman was fallen upon the bed where Esther was. Then said the king, will he force the queen also before me in the house? And so the Lord's in the king's misinterpretation of what was even going on there. But I mean, Haman is cooked meat now. You say, what's the point, Brother Stevens? Well, the Lord uses some things that you might not even notice he's using. So you got to be careful about how you think about things, right? I mean, mundane things, monotonous things, sicknesses, hey, maybe even panic scares, pandemics. You don't know what the Lord's doing. In chapter 8, verse 11, he gives Mordecai as responsible for giving the Jews liberty to fight. It says in verse 11, the king granted the Jews, which were in every city, to gather themselves together and to stand for their life. And because of that, verse 16, the Jews had light and gladness and joy and honor. They were overjoyed because the king had made it legal for them to fight. Now, when you got saved, you know, you didn't have a chance in the battle before you got saved. Now you're saved. The Lord's given you the tools and the weaponry and the mandate, the commission to fight. And that's a privilege, because you were a loser. You were a loser before, for sure. You were already dead in trespasses and sins. So then you see in chapter 10, let's go on down and finish this out. Chapter 10, verse 2. And all the acts of his power and of his might and the declaration of the greatness of Mordecai, whereunto the king advanced him, are they not written in the book of the Chronicles of the kings of Media and Persia? For Mordecai the Jew was next unto the king Ahasuerus, and great among the Jews. I mean, he was the number two guy. It's funny how these number two guys keep rising, right? In captivity, Joseph in Egypt, number two man. Daniel, under Darius and Cyrus, number two man. Third man, under Belshazzar, in captivity of all places. How could somebody expect to advance in captivity? But the Lord does some of his best work in captivity. You know, under terrible conditions. But it's easy to overlook God's hand. You don't know what the Lord's doing always or where he's doing it. And a lot of times it's hidden behind something that you're concerned about, but the Lord's using it all along. He might use things that you wouldn't think of. He might use things that you wouldn't use. But the Lord would, and has. Half the reason that half the preachers in this country are mad at Dr. Ruckman is because God used him when he wouldn't use them for what they wanted. He uses both men and women. I mean, where would this be? Where would this story be? I mean, really, to me, the book is more about Mordecai than Esther, because Esther was doing his bidding. But still, it's obvious he uses both men and women. What began as a soap opera ended in the salvation of a nation. And if that nation, if that story had ended in Esther as it did, there would have been no nation for Jesus Christ to come and save. And all because in a book that God's name is not mentioned, God's hand worked. Hope it's an encouragement. Let's bow our heads and pray. Father, we thank you tonight.